Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Flight Talk podcast. Today, we have Frank on. This is about our fifth time trying to record this. So, fifth time a charm. Frank, welcome. And just give everybody a quick introduction on how you got in aviation and where you're at in your career now.
Hey, thanks. I got into aviation. I think I got the aviation bug back when I was a young kid, just living across the street from the airport. My grandfather, during the summer, and he was a pilot after World War II, so that kind of gave me the bug, I think, and just always the interest in airplanes and what was going on. I got to be, you know, college aged and getting ready to go to schools and trying to figure out what I want to do in my life when I joined the Air Force. I was in the Air Force for 22 years, and after retirement decided that, you know, I wanted to fly the planes and do something fun in retirement, so I did that, worked my way up through CFI, CFII, and was fortunate enough to get hired on with a company as relatively, I would say, inexperienced or young pilot. I got hired on with a company flying corporate jets. So now that's what I'm doing. I'm flying corporate jets around the country, taking people, you know, on vacations. And it's been a great I've been doing this for a little over 2 years now.
Okay. So with your starting out from a young age, like when you were in high school, going to college or graduating high school, did you want to get into aviation or were you set on, you know, you enlisted, correct?
Yes, I enlisted. And I don't know. I always thought about it. And I'll tell you, there was a time when we were riding around and we were out in the woods and we found somebody had like dumped off the big box of books. Well, in those books were some books. Today we would look at them as the GLIM aviation style books, you know, mm-hmm. Big old stack of seven of them and all that. And I remember I was probably in fourth grade and remember looking through the books and like, man, this stuff is difficult. This is, you know, hard. Well, of course, in fourth grade, every math problem looks a little bit more difficult and hard. And it was just stuff like that that always made me think that maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe I'm not smart enough. Maybe I can't figure it out. So I never thought it was an opportunity that I could do. I never, you know, and growing up and living on base, my dad would talk about the flight schools on base, you know, and he's like, hey, if you want to do this, you know, this is something you should do. And I'm like, I don't know if I can do it. And I think I kind of psyched myself out, you know, from a young age. And after I retired, that's when I decided, you know, maybe I got this. I got time on my hands that I could study and, you know, maybe I can do it. And that's how I got going.
Yeah, I agree with you because you and I have a similar paths right out of high school. I enlisted as well. And my dad is a pilot, but I always looked at pilots as these like geniuses, super smart guys. And when you're enlisted in the military, you know, they outrank you automatically and you look up to them like, oh, wow, that, you know, I don't know. I don't think I could ever do that job. And you just have to take like that first step. And it's not smooth sailing, but once you see that it's an attainable goal, it makes it just that much easier. You just have to put the work in. You have to be dedicated. And I feel like a lot of people, that scares them away, especially I would say a lot of enlisted personnel that are very capable of. I think that the military one day could move to having enlisted people flying aircraft. So that would solve their pilot shortage.
Yeah, that's a huge debate. There's some issues with how we conduct operations and things like that and who's allowed to call for those operations. So it's kind of a weird setting or whatever with that. But yeah, it would solve some problems and it's not unprecedented to have, you know, enlisted aviation. So we had enlisted aviators, you know, way back when, and that's how they started. And there's definitely a lot of folks who are capable if they would just give it a shot, you know, just go take a discovery flight and check it out. Go fly with somebody, you know, like yourself, just go fly with them and see what it's about.
Oh yeah, I agree. So with starting out, let's talk a little bit about because you were in aviation in the Air Force. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, starting up from being a young enlisted guy, doing your career all the way from, you know, being an airman up to being a senior NCO, of how that went for you and then how that really pushed you into aviation in your retirement?
Yeah, I spent the majority of the folks that end up on the RC-135s, the reconnaissance jets, they typically, we have a ground mission and then we have an airborne side, an airborne mission. So I did a number of years as, you know, on the ground, kind of, you kind of perfect your trade while you're on the ground in less stressful environments, more oversight and things like that as an airman. And I worked my way up and got to this point, I guess, around Desert Storm. So now I just aged myself. We're talking about the first one. And they asked for volunteers to go and, you know, go airborne and all that. And I volunteered to do it. And I thought, okay, this is where I'm going to go. Well, the war was over in, you know, a matter of 17 days. So there was no need for any extra people, I guess, at that time. And I just kept working, you know, on the ground and kept going along. And I always had this in the back of the mind of something I wanted to do. And I talked to a friend of mine and a supervisor, and I said, "Hey, you know what? I've done, you know, two tours now. I was on my third tour. I was like, I'm ready to go, and I'm ready to fly." And my supervisor happened to have a friend who was on the RC-135s, and he said, "You know what? I'm going to put you in contact with him, and let you two, you know, see what you can work out." And so he did. So I was about 9 years in, and I got the call, and they said, "Go take your physical," and all of that. And then I said, "Okay, that's great." You know, I thought this was going to be a done deal, and you know, I'm going to England. This is going to be awesome. And the physical was a pain because I was overseas, and you're trying to do all this paperwork. But anyway, worked my way up through that. By this time, I was E5, and we didn't get promoted as fast back then. So I wasn't a bad guy. I just didn't get promoted fast.
Yeah.
So then I went to England, and that changed kind of everything for me. By the time I got there, we were doing Operation Allied Force, Southern Watch, Operation Northern Watch. And we had a Baltics and a Barents mission and all of that stuff. So we were very busy and had a really cool stuff. And I had an amazing assignment, and I think those years on the ground kind of working in my trade really helped. I got promoted. I made E6 out of there in my first, I don't know, 2 years, I think, there. And then I got put in charge of standardization and evaluation, stand eval guy, where I'm doing, you know, running the evals and everything for the jet. And just gave me a different perspective on how things were working. So I did 4 years of that, and I was kind of, I wouldn't say, I was getting burnout from the TDYs. There was a lot going on then, you know, from 2000 to 2004. So you can imagine, you know, the places, and we were winding down Allied Force and we're moving into all this new stuff after, you know, September 11th. And I needed a break, and they said, you know, you should go to the schoolhouse and go teach. So I went to the schoolhouse and kind of took some of my experiences from, you know, traveling and flying and being in all these different countries and all of that. And I brought that to the schoolhouse. Well, that worked out into that. My next assignment, I got called, and they asked me to come to the Pentagon to lead my career field, the 1N2, 1N5, so intel analyst. So my next and my last tour was at the Pentagon. By this time, I had made master and senior, and was sitting in line for chief before I decided to retire.
Yeah, so very successful and eventful career. And then after that, how long did it take you after retirement? You know, after a 22-year career of, you know, we all know on the enlisted side of the military, 22 years, it's a long time.
Yeah.
And when did you say, all right, I want to go try this flying thing? I did it as, you know, an intel guy, and yeah, Now I want to be the one flying the plane.
Yeah. Well, you know, my last tour and my last flight coming out, I think we're coming out of Afghanistan, and the company, the squadron commander was on the plane and stuff like that. And he called me up to the cockpit to take some photos and let me sit, you know, in the seat for a little while and, you know, and kind of just cruise around. And it just got me like fired up, like energized that, you know, this is what I want to do. So after I got to Fort Gordon and I got settled in, new house and job and all of that, I was flying home one day. I guess it had been a couple years I'd been here. So I've been out there, yeah, about 2 years, I think. And I was driving home one day and I kept driving by the airport and saying, you know, one of these days, I'm just going to pull into this airport and tell them I want to, you know, I want lessons. I want to go fly. So I was coming home one day and the airplane literally flew right over top of my truck coming into the airport. And I stopped in the middle of the road, turned around and went right back. And I said, that's it. That's the sign. That's all I needed. I'm done. So I walked into the flight school and talked to a guy named John in there. And I said, I want to learn to fly. And he said, well, you know, we'd like to do discovery flights and all this. I said, man, I got 1200 hours in a jet flying all around the country and all around the world. I just want to fly. Like, I already know I'm a like flying. I just want to keep going. And he said, all right, let's go. And so we went out and jumped in the airplane and took my discovery flight and off we went. I never looked back.
Yeah, that's interesting. I remember when I was actually in Korea when I decided I wanted to finally pursue this. And, you know, my girlfriend for a while had been telling me, like, you need to do it. And my dad was always like, man, if you want to do it, you're a smart guy. But I always doubted myself. And what really, like, pushed me to do it, we were at a – I don't know if you've ever been to – you've been to Korea, correct?
Yes.
So we were at our hooch, like our squadron bar, and I was talking to this master sergeant, and he started talking about how he was flying on the outside. And I was like, what? And he's like, well, back in the States, yeah, I'm working on my private pilot license. And I was like, how can you do that? You're enlisted. And he's like, no, you can just pay out of pocket, and then I'm going to use my GI Bill to fund the rest of the training. And I went home that night, and I was just like, man, I got to do this. So that next evening, because it would have been, you know, the morning time in the States, I called this flight school. It was out in Montgomery County, Maryland. And I was just like, hey, look, I want to fly. Like, and they're like, all right, well, when do you want to come in? I'm like, well, 6 months from now, I'm still in Korea. And they were just kind of like, what? And I was like, yep, I'll be there. Like, when can I set up a date? And they'll ask me, you'll be able to get your discovery flight in. And I was like, no, I don't want to do a discovery flight. I want to do my first lesson. And I actually, I knew I wanted to do it. I watched my dad do it, you know, his whole life. And as a kid, you know, I would sit there in class and draw C-17s and KC-10s. And I just, flying has always been something I wanted to do. And I've never been more fulfilled in my life than I am now of flying. And even, you know, the journey of to getting to where you want to go, it's a long process. And I know you know that from working all the way up from, you know, your private to your CFI. But finding like the joy in it and really having fun instead of looking towards that next, you know, that next rating of, oh, I want to be done with this. I want to be going to that. I want to fly something bigger. Yeah. I think we all need to like take a step back and just enjoy the moment, because one day we'll all look back like, man, you know, I wish I could be doing that right now, but I'm flying this big jet.
Yeah.
Everything has its perks. You just got to like, especially even what I've tried to do in the military, you know, we were always looking towards that next assignment. You always hear people saying, oh, I can't wait to PCS and leave the space. And it's just like, you got to enjoy the moment. That like, that's life. It's very interesting how everything comes full circle.
Yeah. And it is. And if you're always looking ahead, you'll not appreciate where you are and, you know, what you have done and all that. And that, you know, you put a lot of time and effort to get to each step, enjoy it along the way. I was looking back and thinking about, you know, as I'm redoing my logbooks and all that stuff and catching everything up. And I look back at sometimes and I'm like, man, these are really fun times when you're a private pilot and you don't have your instrument rating and you're out there and you're trying to figure out the weather and can I make it? Is the crosswinds going to be too much? You know, what can I do? And those are really good times. And there's a lot of learning in those that come in very handy when you, even when you go up through commercial and, you know, and you're doing flying jets, you're still thinking about the weather. You're still thinking about those things. You just got to appreciate, yeah, each step. Because, I mean, there's a long haul between private and instrument and then on to commercial. That those hours, people ask me all the time, how did you get through those hours? I was like, I don't know. Like, I just tried to fly as much as I could. And
yeah,
it did what I could. And all of a sudden, one day I looked up and I was like, I'm at 240 hours. I'm ready. And it does take a while, but just enjoy it. Enjoy the relief and the environment. Like, I've ridden motorcycles since I was, I don't know, four, I think, or something ungodly. I was small. And I always found that when I was on the motorcycle, it was a release from all the other tensions and all the other stress, and just a time when you can get away and think and just be you, you know, just think about stuff that's going on and what you're in the moment right there. And flying is exactly the same relief. Like, I'm up there, I think about nothing. I just, most of the time I'm up there taking videos and, you know, taking a picture or something, and just, that's it. That's all I'm thinking about and just enjoying it.
No, yeah, I agree. It's definitely an escape from reality. It's just where you're up there and you're just having fun, and that smile on your face, like, especially when you get to bring up like a buddy or a friend or a family member for the first time, it's just such, all that hard work pays off. And, but it's really true what you're talking about, how it's like, it's kind of like a blur going from your private to your instrument to your commercial, of all that time just kind of mashed together when you look back. And it, in the moment, it does seem like forever. I'm almost at 200 hours now with my commercial, and looking back from my private, it seems like ages ago, but it really doesn't at the same time. It all just kind of meshes together.
Yeah. Well, I would say I get a, you know, one of those Facebook alerts, and it says, oh, here's a picture from X years ago, you know, and all. And my picture the other day was one of my commercial cross countries, might have been my long commercial cross country or something like that, which, you know, turned into a 6 hour, 6.5 hour day or something. But they, it's fun to look back at those and be like, man, that was just 4 years ago. You know, just 4 years ago, I'm, you know, just sitting, sweating it out in an airplane. You know, it does. So while sometimes the numbers can seem daunting and far away, when you look back at it, you're like, man, that really was a quick time, or that wasn't as long as I thought it was going to be. And people in this industry also are there to help. I was fortunate, the flight school that I worked for, ended up working for, the owner needed a piece of paper, literally one single sheet of paper he needed. And it was in Columbia, South Carolina, which was about an hour flight, maybe over an hour flight back. But you know what? That was 2 hours that I didn't pay for flight. He just needed the paper picked up, and he said, will you go get it for me? I'm like, sure. So he gave me the airplane and off I went, you know, and flew the airplane over there, walked in the FBO, picked up the piece of paper, and flew right on home.
Nice. Yeah, ironically, I lived in Columbia, South Carolina for a while. My girlfriend went to school there. It's a good town.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's where I'm going to be based, I think, with the new airplane, is in Columbia.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So we'll be flying the Falcon 50 out of there. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
So with your training from your private instrument commercial and then your CFI and II, what were some things you struggled with? Where was a point in your training where you felt like maybe you hit a brick wall, like you didn't know if you could progress, or you just were struggling in general?
Something I struggled with, you know, I don't know if I can pick out one thing that I struggled with. I think with instrument, I struggled with like spatial awareness sometimes. And you find that, like, when you're in the simulator and things happen and you're turned and you're giving, you can't see where everything is or where you're going. Understanding, no kidding, where's north? You know, just being able to get yourself in a good situation. That's always been a weird thing, and something that I'm very conscious of is understanding that those spatial illusions and all of the things that come into it, those things are difficult. And then some things with, it's, all about like the aeronautics, the physics of the aeronautics. And maybe that's where my training is lacking, is some things with that. I have to really consciously think about questions. So I'm studying for the ATP test tomorrow, right? And there'll be questions in there about longitudinal and, you know, stability and axes and all that axes. And I have to like conscious, sometimes I have to draw it out. And I think that has been my biggest struggle, you know, is just understanding those and not understanding just the answer to the question, because I can figure that out, but it's the understanding of the why does this happen, you know, and things like that. So that, I think that's been the hardest thing to get over and to really learn. If you load an equipment in the back of the airplane and create an aft CG, what does that really mean? You know, what does that affect and how does it affect it? And what are the forces on the wing, on the stabilizer, on, you know, and those kind of things. So,
no, I agree. That's probably the one thing I struggle with as well, because it's not something you can regurgitate. You have to sit there and think about it and you have to picture it in your head. And like you said, you have to draw it out, because thinking about it in your head, you just confuse yourself.
Every time. It's very difficult. And because everything's working opposite, right? So mm-hmm. your mind is like really confused. I think the greatest question that can be asked is of a commercial guy going for his commercial multi-engine is, what's the anti-servo tab do and how does it work? Because that will really blow you away, right? Because you're thinking, oh, I got a stabilizer and it goes up and down and that moves forces of the nose up and down. Well, then what's the anti-servo do, right? Because that moves in the opposite direction as the regular servo tab. It's, and you can't wrap your head around it. And I think the DPEs know that. Yeah. They're ready to ask it. They're like, hey, so what's that do anyway? Why is that there, you know?
Yeah. So with you going more into your training, what was the hardest rating you think that you had to go through training wise? And
hardest training rating is your instrument. I think that's the hardest training rating. You have the biggest learning curve, I believe, during that portion. There's just so, because you're coming out of it, right, as maybe a 40 or 50 hour pilot, even 60 hour pilot, you're coming out of it and there's a lot to learn. There's radio work, there's, you know, flying the airplane, which you're good at, but you're not proficient enough to, you know, fly in the weather and all of those things. So I think that's the biggest learning curve. The rest of them build on the instrument and you really find yourself as a pilot and, you know, you start figuring it out then. A lot of folks will say your CFI is your hardest. And I've always been under the belief that if you studied along the way and you really and truly learned and you become a professional at this, by the time you make it to CFI, that ride should be more about you just explaining to a friend how to fly than anything else. If you treat it that way and not overstress, I think it's a good way. Now, it does have a high failure rate. So I would say if there's one you got to really watch, it's the CFI one, because you could probably fail that one pretty easily. But I do think the instrument is your hardest in rating.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, I haven't gone through the CFI training. The commercial training hasn't been difficult. The maneuvers, like you said, explaining them, my instructor will be like, hey, I'm just a DPE. Mm-hmm. Tell me what you're doing. And it helps a lot. It really does. I actually took a neighbor up not too long ago, and he told me at the end of the flight, he was like, dude, you did a really good job of explaining everything. It put me at ease because you were telling me what everything was doing, how, you know, it affected the aircraft, how the aerodynamics, and constantly practicing like that. Once you get to that check ride, it's like, it's just like another flight with another friend. Besides that, you know, the person sitting right next to you isn't saying anything.
Yeah. But yeah, that's really it. It just fly and have fun and, you know, work on that craft of, once you got the maneuvers down, hey, this is why I'm doing it. And this is how I'm going to do it. And this is what the result is going to be. And if you could talk someone through that pretty smoothly, yeah, the CFI ride shouldn't be bad at all. And yeah. It's a long day though.
No, yeah, I've heard nightmare stories of,
yeah,
I just had a friend do it and he was like, yeah, we started at 8 and we ended up at 6.
Yeah. I think mine was 9 to 5 or 9 to 4 or something, 9 to 4:30. I mean, it was late, but I think by the time he signed my logbook, I was back in the airplane by about 5:30 to fly home. I just remember that flight home. I was in Myrtle Beach flying home and I was like, my gosh, I can't wait to get home. It's been a day.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, that's nuts. We're lucky enough at our flight school, we have DP authority. So our chief pilot can actually give us all our check rides up until I believe they don't have double I, but they have MEI. So you can do your multi-engine instructor, but the only one we don't have yet, I think, is the CFII. I may be wrong, but that definitely helps a lot, knowing who your DP is going to be, seeing their face a lot, knowing their isms, the things that they like, the things they like to do, ask. But yeah, like you said, at the end of the day, it really is, if you truly learn the material and you don't learn it to regurgitate it on a check ride and then dump it all, I mean, it shouldn't be any different than just explaining a flight to a friend.
Yeah, it really isn't. It's a fun check ride. Once you get in the air, it could be a little grueling on the ground, but I will say my Air Force time as an instructor helped out tremendously, because you're very comfortable standing in front of people. You're comfortable, you know, giving back information and being able to interact. And those things are, you know, if you can be very engaging on how you're giving your presentation, that definitely helps. And, you know, they're looking for you to be accurate and teach correctly and, you know, not be your head down in the books that you've made and all those things. If you could do that and do that smoothly, I think you'll be really successful on the check ride.
No, I agree. And I think the military definitely does come into play with the whole, you know, going through a check ride. Even in my career, every year we have to go to stand eval, we have to get recertified. Every morning when we have our, we call it roll call guard mount training, you know, we have an individual brief a certain topic, so we all kind of stay proficient on the knowledge, because most of the time, you know, if you don't use it, you lose it. And that, I mean, that does help on check rides for me, because I'm very comfortable speaking in front of people now, giving presentations, being evaluated. I've been doing it since I was 19. So that stuff all does come into play and it does really help. It does.
Yeah.
But back to the instrument training. So I agree with you. I did feel like that was so far out of the three ratings that I've been training for. The instrument was so difficult because of the learning curve of thinking differently, not keeping your eyes outside the airplane, constantly scanning, thinking it like ahead of the plane to set yourself up. That was probably the most difficult for me, of getting used to that process of always having one, you know, that next move, like ahead of the plane. You need to have everything set up. Specifically, did you ever, like, with, I felt like DME arcs were probably the hardest thing for me to understand.
Yeah.
At first. Yeah. And if you told me to fly one right now, I'd be like, oh, let me take some time to study for that one.
Yeah, fly 10, twist 10. They are a tough one to get through. I think now with the advent of the GPS, and the GPS is being able to fly the, you know, help you fly the arc or fly the arc for you, you know, it'll take some of the stress out. But my gosh, there was the DME arc at coming off of Athens area and stuff like that up there. I probably wore a track out trying to figure it out, you know. And they're just tricky, and it's one of those things too, because it's backwards, right, in your mind. It you're flying backwards to where you want to go, and you know, your headings and all, and you're like, why am I twisting this to the left, or why am I twisting this to the right? Because again, there's no roadmaps up there. You're having to figure this out as you go. And it is difficult. They're fun. And they're a great challenge. luckily, in you know today's day and age, we don't have to do NDB approaches too much anymore, at least in the U.S. Overseas in Europe and stuff like that, they still do quite a few NDBs, as I understand it. So, but yeah, those were fun. Those are definitely fun. But there's nothing more fun. I just shot two approaches yesterday to minimums. There's really nothing more fun than that.
No, yeah, I agree. My first ever actual instrument flight in the aircraft, I was lucky enough to get to see what it was like. Obviously, my instructor had most of the controls, but we flew an approach down to probably 300 feet, and the minimums were 298. As we said, you know, runway in sight, we heard minimums. Yeah. I was like, dude, is every flight like this? My instructor was like, no, man, I've never flown an approach down to minimums until now.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, cool.
It definitely grabs your attention. And I always tell people, you know, they ask, would you do it in a single pilot environment? I'd have to have a single pilot, really capable airplane, a great GPS and autopilot to whoever want to do it single pilot. You know, we do it in the jet with two pilots and it's still a workload. You know, yesterday I was flying and the co-pilot, he's looking out the window, he's doing all the stuff, making all the call outs, he's talking on the radio. So he's got half of the job himself. All I have to do is monitor the aircraft systems and fly, make sure that, you know, it's, we're on glide and make sure that we're doing everything. Speeds are right. And you get down on the ground and you both look at each other like, all right, we did that one well, or hey, what could we have done better? You know, and all that. But yeah, that's nothing much more fun than that.
No, yeah, definitely. And that crew environment, that CRM, you don't really learn about that and while you're doing your training. And most people, I mean, that I'm training with, everybody wants to go to the airlines. It's a big pathway to the airlines. And I have a buddy who, he goes to Penn State, but during the summers he comes home and he knocked out his commercial this summer and his instrument. And whenever we fly together, he's like, hey, let's try to, you know, get into the habit of using CRM. So I got the radios because we flew up to JFK, three of my buddies. And we needed that. I remember we were coming in on, it was into Teterboro. I think it was the ILS. And you know that 1,500 foot,
yes.
Like, you have to be there. And my buddy, I think, was like 30 or 40 feet above. And the controller just started yelling at him, telling him to get down, you know, you're busting my airspace, blah, blah, blah. And but CRM really does come into play, especially at those big airports. And, you know, young bucks like us that are just working on our commercial, I mean, you can do some damage if you're not up to speed, especially single pilot. I mean,
yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot going on sometimes, single pilot to do it. It really is. Yeah, CRM is the way. I mean, the Air Force was fortunate enough to teach us about, you know, CRM and safety and mishaps and all those kind of things, you know, when you're in that aviation side of things. And that's a big thing for us, is talking it through. I mean, I remember I was coming into Tallahassee and I was doing an approach in there, and we had low visibility, but we had our visibility was, I think we were three quarters of a mile or a mile visibility, and, you know, 200 or 300 overcast with mist. So, I mean, we knew coming in, we weren't going to see the airport till the last minute. We knew everything. And the co-pilot called out that he had the airport in sight, and I didn't say anything because I'm just concentrating now on getting autopilot off and landing this thing. And he's kind of looking over at me. He's like, I have the airport in sight. I was like, I know, I heard you. I'm sorry. You know, like just even that, like I was locked into my own zone of not letting them know that I'm continuing. I'm not about to throttle up and go around or, you know, anything like that. Or like, okay, just that one acknowledgement, you know, can cause stress in the cockpit. So there's little things like that, you know, just that caught those call outs and those responses, and they're anticipated and they're needed to keep everyone on the same page. So we all know what's going on and what we can anticipate, what's going to happen.
No, I agree. Yeah, no, it's CRM. I mean, it's especially with, you know, having two pilots, you got to have that communication. Otherwise things can get lost and mistakes can be made. But
yeah.
So onwards to your CFI, how long did you instruct until you got that job, that gig flying jets?
I was instructing for about, oh gosh, 7-8 months when I sent them an email and said, hey, you know, just letting you know that I'm coming up on 500 hours and I've been instructing here on the field. And if you're just looking for someone to fill the right seat of that pretty king area you have sitting over there, I'd be more than happy to go with you and all those kind of things. And so, yeah, it wasn't very long. And then I sent them the email, and within a week, I think I received the email from them asking if I could meet with them, meet with the chief pilot and the DO of the company. And I was thinking, wow, okay, so I'll go and meet with them. You know, I had no idea. I was still working full time at my retirement gig and CFIing on the side, and, you know, life was good. And yes, went in and met with them, and they said, what do you want to do? I said, well, I'd really like to fly the King Air and, you know, just kind of fill in and maybe work a few days a month here and there with you and all that. And they said, well, unfortunately, we're getting rid of the King Air, and kind of took the wind out of my sails right there. And then they said, but we do have a position flying the right seat in this Citation jet, if you'd be interested. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what, you know, what was going to happen. And so I came out of the meeting basically with a class date to go to flight safety and get my first type rating at 501 hours.
So do you think for someone, you know, in back in your shoes, say they're a 23-year-old CFI, they're at 500 hours, say pre, you know, jump a year ahead from now, COVID isn't, you know, restricting aviation, we're all, you know, the market's back up. Would you tell, you know, a 23-year-old CFI with 500 hours, hey, man, go send that email. Go, you know, put yourself out there. What do you think that it's the right thing to do? Do you think they should stay instructing for a little bit? What would you say to someone in your shoes?
If you're on the field and you have a local 135 operator or a Part 91, you know, owner operator on the field, and you can introduce yourself and be around and learn and meet the people, I would say that is the way to go, is talk to them, put yourself out there, you know, be at the airport often, because you never know what somebody might need or when somebody might say, hey, I'm looking for a pilot, or I need somebody to fly me to, you know, here or there. And those little opportunities can lead to so much more. I happen to have met the owner of the company at the airport, you know, a couple different times, and didn't really talk much. We just in passing saying hi and all of this. So when you sit down and then you meet them, you know, for the first time, they're like, oh, you're not unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. And they know, and they're like, you know, they're going to ask you, what have you been doing? You've been CFI, CFII. Okay, cool. What have you been flying? And that's one of the things I can say for a CFI. If you can fly anything, fly. Don't stick to, you know, well, I like to fly the 172, or I like to fly the Cherokee. If you can get in the seat and learn to fly a wide range of aircraft, do that. It'll make you a better pilot in the end. And people will see that. And I think it makes them more comfortable that you're able to move into different planes. That's not saying that you can't be a 1500 hour C-172 guy and go to the airlines, because you certainly can. Many have done it, but I would say fly anything and everything you can get your hands on and learn to fly. And that will definitely help.
No, I agree. I have a buddy, that same kid that goes to Penn State, he's checked out, I think, in every single aircraft at our flight school. And I'm just like, I would love to have the finances to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the way my bank account's set up.
Yeah. I was fortunate. I had a guy and an instructor. The instructor said, hey, we have an opportunity if you want to go, and we're going to take this Turbo 206. To Kansas to drop off the owner and his dad and his brother. So I sat in the back, you know, and flew this Turbo 206 in the back and watching and learning and, you know, as much as I could. And the owner on the way, when we were getting ready to turn around from Kansas and fly home, he said, Frank, you want to fly it? So he let me fly his airplane home from Kansas.
That's
so
awesome.
So I got to spend, you know, a few hours in a turbo 206 learning how to fly it, learning how, you know, how everything works and working a turbo system and all of that. So that was nice, and that was leading into my commercial. That was right not long before after my instrument. I was probably about 30 hours from my commercial, and so that was a really good experience. Well, then I moved into some guy that I knew bought a turbo 182, and I started helping him, you know, in a turbo 182 because I had experience with big turbo heavy nose aircraft like a 206. And I said, yeah, I'm comfortable flying this thing. So I flew him around and flew him back and forth to go on golf trips in his turbo 182 and until he got comfortable enough to fly it himself. And that's fly anything. If you can get in it, learn to fly it, and it will just make your transition to other airplanes and to bigger, faster moving airplanes that much easier.
No, I agree. And it's interesting how you're saying hang around the airport and like be present, because I have a buddy who his owner of his flight school is like, hey, I have to go pick a friend up. His plane broke down. Do you want to ride, you know, just right seat in a little 172 with me? And he was like, yeah, sure. And so they flew down to somewhere in Texas, and on the way back, the guy was like, told my buddy, he was like, hey, here's my business card. I operate a company. We have about 12 PC-12s. So if you're interested, when you're at 250 hours, you give me a call after that commercial check ride. And he was only like 25 hours shy. So the day he got his check ride, he called that guy. And the guy was like, oh, yeah, I'd love for you to come work for me. When can you start? We can get you on. And he flew PC-12s for about a year and a half. He worked in like the egress section of a fighter squadron, getting all their gear ready as a senior airman, and built about, I think, 600 or 700 hours, picked up for pilot training, and now is flying F-16s.
Yeah.
So it's funny how everything works out sometimes, you know, the right place, the right time.
That's right. And yeah, the airport, if you want to be in aviation, the airport is the right place.
No. Yeah.
I listened to Jason Shepard a while back. I mean, three, four years ago. And I remember him talking about some times when he was like, you know, I was a hangar rat. He said, I just hung around the hangars all the time and all that. And that kind of stuck with me, you know, and I was like, if I'm always at the airport and I have nothing else better to do, I had to drive by it to go home. Might as well stop and see what's going on. And that's kind of how I picked up that trip to go pick up the paper for the owner. The owner just didn't have the time. And he was like, calls in and said, is Frank around? And I was sitting in the simulator doing instrument work. And they walked in the simulator and said, hey, Frank, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm just playing in the sim. Said, Keith wants to know if you want to go to Columbia and pick up this piece of paper. So just being there, being at the airport, got me, you know, a little over 2 hours of flying time and a cross country trip. And, you know, cause we all know that we need those cross country hours too. So, you know, just little things like that. You got to be there though to do it. And when you're there, one thing I could recommend is dress professionally as you can. You know, we all want to wear shorts and flip flops and, you know, our favorite ball cap and t-shirt, but sometimes being around the airport, we got to be the part, right? Dress for the job you want, not the one you have. It's kind of that same mantra. So just be professional. And I think everything usually will work out.
No, I agree. I agree 100%. So with your training, moving on now to moving from, you know, a little small single engine aircraft to a jet, how was that transition like? What were some things that, you know, you found difficult? And how did that training go overall?
The training was great. The transition was, I don't want to say overwhelming. The transition wasn't necessarily overwhelming. It was the flying speeds that you had to kind of figure out. You're no longer doing, you know, 80 knots in the traffic pattern. you're doing 250 and slowing to 200 to drop gear at 175, you know, like to put all of that into perspective, how you were going to do that and what those things needed to look like. That was the part that was like overwhelming. You had to look at things differently. You know, you're at 36,000 feet and you're 100 miles away. How are you going to get down? You know, what's the rate in which you're going to drop down, and where do you need to be down to get into those traffic patterns? And, you know, cause you got to fly a normal pattern into these little airports. And then material, like studying and all of that kind of stuff, when you go to flight safety or, you know, one of these other big companies that do this professional training, they're giving you the knowledge that you need. You're going through all the systems and you're looking at the systems and how all the hydraulics work, how the pneumatics of everything work, and the electrical, the fuel flows. So that part gets a little overwhelming, because no one's, even in commercial, they don't ask you, well, how does the hydraulic isolator work? You know, and does it fail open or fail closed? You know, they don't ask you typically all of those type of questions, but they do prepare you, and they prepare you for that. And they take that knowledge and they put that knowledge into the sim, into actual use, you know, and say, okay, well, here's a, you know, an engine out here. Here's a fire situation. Do you have a fire, or do you just have a flame out? Do you have a ring that's hot, and that's why your fire light went off? You know, things to think about as you go through it. And they really do make that transition into your first type rating pretty good. I would say the airlines, from what I understand, they're really tight on the way that they want you to fly and those kind of things. So I did the 777 simulator at Delta, and the sim instructor, you know, was kind of giving us some differences on how they fly and how they do things and all that. So they're a little bit more strict on how they want you to approach airports and approach the flying. They like to use a constant rate of descent type deal, an angle. And so they're looking for a tighter profile is all, where we're given a little bit more leeway on how we want to land the plane. But yeah, I mean, it's another thing. It's a study thing. It's an event. So you just look at it like that. You say, you know what? I'm here. Obviously the company thinks I'm good enough to be here. I just need to study and take this time to really buckle down and find a study buddy, because you're going to need to chair fly like crazy. Cause you have to know all the emergency procedures by heart. Yeah. That first type rating oral is pretty rough. It's long.
Yeah. Longer than the CFI?
No. I think it was 2 hours. There was 9 pages of questions. But, you know, there's hundreds of dials and buttons and knobs and this and that they can ask you. So the instructor, you know, the DPE sat there with a laser thing and he pointed to one of the lights on the panel. He's like, so when this light goes off, what are the 5 things that happen? You know, and you got to rattle those things off. And then he's pointing at something else. What happens when this does this? And you're like, oh, and it's a lot, you know, and you even could like look at yourself and go, man, there's no way I can remember all this, but you'd be amazed. You know, you come out of good 2 weeks, 3 weeks of training. And, you know, if you really put in the time and the effort and the study, they know when you're ready and what you can do. And then once you get in the sim, just fly and go have fun, because it's a big fat commercial check ride with some emergency procedures thrown in.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. No, so from here on out, I mean, you're getting a new type rating, correct? You're flying a different jet coming up?
I am. I go to school on September 13th to fly the Falcon 50 and the 900 series Falcons.
That's exciting.
So, yeah. It's going to be interesting to fly a jet with 3 holes in it. So,
yeah. So, yeah, no, definitely. So to wrap things up, if you know, you're, say you're earlier on in your enlistment, would you have, if you knew what you knew now, would you have done all this while you were active duty? Would, if you had the funds or, you know, the GI Bill, I know that kicked in after 9/11, but would you have taken advantage of those benefits and started flying earlier? Or are you happy where you're at right now?
That's a tough question. I should have, when I was stationed at Fort Meade, and I should have taken advantage of the Fort Meade Flying Club back in 1993. I probably should have taken advantage of that. If nothing more, if I would have just used the flying club there, because I can't remember what it was per hour. I want to say it was something like $30 an hour or something like that to fly. So I should have taken advantage of that and got my private pilot's license then. And I don't know how that would have changed the rest of my career in life, you know, and all, but just having that done, I think would have changed things, you know, here and there for sure. Like I don't know, maybe I didn't stay in the Air Force. Maybe I didn't retire, you know, maybe I moved on and went to do something else because, you know, back then you could be a commercial pilot, 250 hours and sit in the right seat of a regional jet. So I don't know. I don't know how that would have affected things, but I like where I'm at now. I like what I do. Corporate flying is a lot of fun. And we get to go a lot of different places and see a lot of different stuff. We're always doing something different. Yeah.
Okay. So last thing, you have, you know, an 18, 19 year old, they're enlisting in the military and they're like, well, I want to be a pilot. What would you tell them?
They're going to go enlisted.
Say, yeah, you got an enlisted guy. Yeah. They signed a 4-year contract and they're like, my main end goal is to be a pilot. What would you tell them?
I would say, go in, be good at your job, take what the Air Force has given you, take the training that the Air Force has given you, and be good and learn, you know, your trade and those kind of things. And that will give you more free time to, when you're going to school, pursue those opportunities. If you're going to use your GI Bill or use a TA, you know, to fund school and sign up and go and pick one of these schools that have online training that are paired with a flight school and chase your dream and go after it. But let the Air Force enable you. So we always have to remember the service is one of the few industries in the world where you eventually have to get out. So let that industry enable you to get where you want to go. And the first thing to do that is be good at your job, because if you're good at your job while you're in the Air Force, you'll be good at your job later.
No, I agree.
You'll buckle down later and you'll struggle and you'll fight and you'll get through all those things. But being good at your job first will give you that opportunity.
I agree. I mean, the Air Force, I wish a lot of people knew more about it, about, and you know, the GI Bill, you don't have to go into $80,000 of debt to pay for your flight training. You know, as a young guy, you could do 4 years in the military. I know the Army even offers 3-year contracts, but I don't know who'd want to join the Army, you know, us Air Force guys.
Yeah.
But they offer, you know, the GI Bill is essentially they're paying, it's going to be upwards to $150,000 for, you know, going through Liberty University for my school. And I'm not paying a dime, and I'm blessed for it. And I try to tell everybody that I meet over Instagram or, you know, even my buddies in the military, like, take advantage of that GI Bill, because it will take you places that you never thought you could.
Yeah, for sure. You got to use the GI Bill to fund what you want to do, you know, whether that's in aviation, or some people say, you know, if you're not going to go to aviation school and you could, you know, do things on the side and pay for it on the side and go along that way, you know, do that. And, you know, use the Air Force to get a different degree to have so you're kind of diversified, because as we know, this aviation industry is up and down based on the economy and all of those things. So just depends on what you want to do and how you want to do it. How fast do you want to do it? You know, what is it? What's your goal? If your goal is to get to the airlines, I would definitely say picking one of the good online universities to to get you there through Liberty and others, that's the way to do it.
No, I agree. And Frank, where can what's your Instagram handle name again so everybody can go give you a follow?
It's Aviate First. It's an A-V and then the number 8 and First. And yeah, I'm on there. I'd post, you know, flying around, whether I'm in the jet, you know, or wherever I'm going. And sometimes I post pictures of just me flying in the Mooney, going back and forth to work or wherever I'm flying. Sometimes I post about going to breakfast.
Yeah.
You just never know. But that's the fun thing about aviation. It's just anything that and everything that we can do and all that with it. It just opens up so many other avenues.
No, it does. It does. It nothing beats it. But Frank, I appreciate you coming on today. It was good chatting with you. I mean, after us trying to get this to work for, you know, I believe it was the 5th time, we finally got it done. But again, thank you for coming on, and I wish you the best of luck with your upcoming type rating, and hopefully we can link up if you're ever in out in the D.C. area. You just give me a call.
Okay, we'll do, and thanks for having me, and I'll let you know how the type rating goes.
All right, Frank, I appreciate it.
See you, man.
All right, later.